Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hello. Hello. We're almost there.
All right.
Hey, long time no hear.
Yeah. How you doing?
Doing well. Super excited to hear you again.
Well, I'm alive. That's about it.
Oh, man. I hear you.
Yeah, we're a couple minutes early yet anyway, so...
Well, I'm going to start recording about 30 seconds. No, actually, right now.
Okay.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to a special edition Thursday night here, Wednesday night, excuse me, here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're pleased to bring back an information provider from some of our past shows, returning again, very excited, on the subject of credit cards, Mr. Michael Maris. My name is Martin. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do were they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on and virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of your remedies in the law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network, though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Well, maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. I mean, for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions and all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedy to the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button, fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. That every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over here at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make, if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best. And believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen. And when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, I want to thank you so very much.
All right.
For the time that you've given us at this moment to give a good disclaimer for what we're doing here. It's important. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to share with you that we have a new information provider that is coming on board or is on board. His inaugural was last week. And we had a great turnout tonight as well. I want to thank you for joining us. Now, here's the 40,000-foot view. Whether you are an entrepreneur, a business owner, or you are an employee for someone, wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if you could operate through an LLC that ultimately generated a zero tax consequence for the profits that you made, the money that you made on your labor, on your time? And that's exactly what you're going to hear about tonight. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to Herr Slevin, Mr. Slevin, and he will share with you what he's doing, and then we'll open it up for questions and answers. Mr. Slevin?
Oktong, how? No, not him. Can you hear me?
Hear you perfectly clear, yes. Thank you.
Very good. Herr Slevin here. I'd like to start out with a little bit of a history lesson again, just to give you some ideas of what we have here in this union that is known as the United States of America. The Constitution was ratified and approved on June 21st of 1788. That's the Constitution for the United States. And the Bill of Rights, which we all hold so dear, which really should have said the Bill of Restrictions, because if you read it, that's exactly what you see. It's nothing but what the government cannot do and shall not do. However, they've twisted that rather well, which was that was done in December 15th of 1791. So roughly 80 years later, there was a thing called the District of Columbia Organic Act of 1871. There is much discussion upon this. Some say it turned it into it gave the United States a corporate enclave, and it situated the towns of Washington and Georgetown into a full territorial government called the District of Columbia. We'll leave some of those discussions for another time. However, in Title 28, United States Code 3002, definitions, it says, as used in this chapter, and number 15, quote, United States, end quote, means a federal corporation. I would suggest that this put the United States, aka District of Columbia, in the same class as the City of London, which is a 1 square mile enclave in Greater London, UK, and the Vatican. Just a little bit about the City of London. It is the financial center of the world. I happen to know of a gentleman who was able to access the vault of the UK and saw the evidence where he was received a $5 billion payment through the bank, through Barclay Bank, to one here in the Union. Unfortunately, that unnamed secret society has engineered this man's incarceration. Continuing on, what we find ourselves with, despite the contradictions and the fact checkers, are the three centers that rule the world: the Vatican, City of London, and D.C. It is a triad of evil, if you will. If not evil, at least control. And so in order to make payments for the various loans and bonds and other financial instruments that DC has foisted upon us, they've pledged the American people as the collateral. And the Social Security Act of 1935, if you take the time to read it in the original text at the statutes at large, which I highly suggest everyone do, you'll find that it was done in 11 separate titles. Title 1 was old age assistance for the states. Title 2 is the federal Social Security Number Act, which says that there is an account in the Treasury of the United States for every qualified individual that applies. And it is known as a reserve account. And reserve is another word for escrow. So why would they need an escrow account for people that were just out there doing their things, living life and enjoying things? So the people that put this all together and do the word craft to obscure the various things that we've just stated are known as lexicographers. And in lexicographers, the Supreme Court in Merchants Loan and Trust Company v. Simtanka at 28, he says, in determining the definition of a word income thus arrived at, this court has consistently refused to enter into the refinements of lexicographers or economists and has approved in the definition quoted what is believed to be the commonly understood meaning of the term, which must have been in the minds of the people when they adopted the 16th Amendment of the Constitution. So here we have a statement of lexicographers and their refinements. And looking further into this particular decision, I come up with this is the court in very lawyerly language declaring that lexicographers are smarmy buggers. And we can discuss that at some other time. And what they do is the lexicographer's craft is measured by a thing called the Flesch Index. That's spelled F-L-E-S-C-H. It runs from 1 to 100, and it measures the comprehension of the English language. So just for an example, we have the standard newspaper is written at about 8.5. A first-year college student understands at roughly 11. And a law school graduate comprehends somewhere around 15. The tax code in particular is written at an average of 33 with pieces as high as 55. In other words, these lexicographers want to make sure that average American, if you will, has no flippin' idea what they're saying. And as we've seen in the past decade or two, the fact checkers and the people that pull their strings and pay their checks are determined to make sure that this any possible reasonable opposition to the lexicographer's terms are branded as conspiracy theorists and canceled at the earliest opportunity. So that's what we're dealing with. Now, going back and reading the statutes at large, which takes some time and takes understanding the lexicographer's craft, we find that the 16th Amendment, which says something to the effect that Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, comma, upon whatever source derived, comma, without apportionment, without any reference to census enumeration. So they're given a power, but they're given a power to do what? Well, if we look at the Constitution, we find that there are two great classes of taxation. They are direct and indirect. Direct is done by apportionment, and indirect, which is probably best kept mentally separated by using the word excise. Excises must be uniform throughout all the states. So the three taxable categories that occupy our universe are people, property, and activities. And if anybody out there wants to come up with a fourth thing, I would be very glad to hear it. So people and property are done by apportionment. They are directly taxed by a census in which they count all the noses, and every owner of a nose pays a certain amount. This is also known as a capitation or head tax. And then the property is valued, and a small piece of a small percentage of it is paid by the owner as the direct tax on the property. So we now, that leaves us with excise taxes, and excise taxes are only on activities. Now, there's two ways of measuring activity. You can, for taxation purposes, you can count or enumerate everything that's produced by the activity, or you can put something, a flat tax, upon the measure, something that's required for the activity. And one of the easy ways of showing this is when you ask, is there an excise tax upon whiskey? Well, no, because whiskey is the production of distillation, which is an activity. And it's a privileged activity. The Supreme Court has also said you can't excise tax something that's required for right for life. Now, there will be some people that will argue that distillation and whiskey are definitely needed for life, but that's for another time. So the excise tax is upon whiskey, but it's truly, that's the measure of the tax, or one way of measuring it. And the distillation is actually the subject of the tax. So we have the measure, the subject, and the statement of liability, which would be the owner of the distillery. So, again, they can put it on the production, in which every bottle has a stamp on it. I'm sure you've seen that. Or they can put a flat tax on the distillery, the possibilities, the, you know, that word left the building, the amount that the distillery can possibly do in a year. Anyway, those are the two ways that you can measure an excise. You can measure the output, or you can put it on something necessary for the activity, such as the distiller. So we have, in order, so all that being said, we can say that now the two types of taxation, direct and excise, must have, in order to stay constitutional, a subject, a measure, and a statement of liability. Elsewise, nobody would be able to figure this out. So the 16th Amendment was passed, and right after that, on August 5th, 1909, they passed the Revenue Act, and it says, there is hereby imposed an excise tax upon income with respect to doing business in the corporate capacity. So it's an excise tax because it's an activity. It says it's upon income, but that's not the subject, that is the measure. So there are a whole bunch of people got together and said that, this is not a good tax. And it all came into the Supreme Court in 1910. And a case called Flint v. Stone Tracy, which was relitigated in 1911. So from that case at 151, we see the statement. The tax under consideration, as we have construed the statute, may be described as an excise upon a particular privilege of doing business in a corporate capacity, i.e., with the advantages which arise from the corporate or quasi-corporate organization. And just as a side note, that quasi-corporate organization includes insurance companies as the main thrust of it. To continue, or when applied to insurance companies for doing the business as such companies. At 152, it says, if business is not done in the manner described in the statute, no tax is payable. And further on down in Flint v. Stone Tracy, that said that the private firm is not subject to the income tax, or private individuals, or private partnerships. And synonyms for not subject to are not liable for or immune versus exempt. In law, exempt means that, yeah, you fall into that category, but the legislators in our largesse exempt you from the penalty. That is entirely different from being immune, which means you can't do it because you don't fall into the category whatsoever. So now we have this thing, and because of Flint v. Stone Tracy in the 1913 Revenue Act, which was done in October after the 16th Amendment was supposedly ratified in February, I believe. So October of 1913, just before the Federal Reserve Act, we have this Revenue Act that says there is hereby imposed a tax upon income, and they got to leave out the rest with respect to, and then so they have the shorthand now. It's a tax on income of 1% of the first $5,000 after the first $5,000, I believe. And that was called the normal tax. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the Congress decided they would call it a normal tax. Is that not some lexicographer manipulation there? Nonetheless, this continues to be used in the statutes of 1916, 1918, 1922, and so forth and so on, all the way down to 1935, Social Security Act, which we mentioned earlier. In Title 8, it says there is hereby imposed a tax upon income with respect to doing business in the corporate capacity, with respect to employment. And so everybody goes, okay, well, you know, I'm an employee, so because I work for an employer and he pays me. However, if you go right over to Title 11, I believe in Section B, it says that the term employee includes the officer of a corporation, which ties it straight back to the 1909 law. And then they changed the definition, which we can see that that happens all the time and very succinctly by these lexicographers. And it says the terms includes and including shall not be deemed to exclude other things otherwise within the term defined. If you analyze that, there's about three sets of double negatives. Take all those out. And it simply says the terms includes and including shall be deemed to be only what is in the term defined, which is that list. And there's also a court case that says the same thing. I don't have it in front of me at this point. So now we know that by what Congress wrote down in their lexicographer's way, that the income tax of the 16th Amendment is only upon doing business in a corporate capacity being measured by income. That's it. So you know, there's probably 4 million words or so in the Internal Revenue Code, and it could probably be cut down to about 4,000 and include everything that it does now by simply staying within the constitutional confines of the two classes of taxation, direct and excise, and the three classes of taxable, which are people, property, and activity. That's it. And if they would just write it, then everybody would be happy. And we wouldn't have this overt river of money flowing toward D.C. every year called the income tax. So, what our company has done is we've done all this research, and that's just the highlights of it, which is probably worth about two PhDs worth of study. And we have come up with a way to build a private firm in which that by the previously stated statutes and decisions that all business done under our private firm is income tax free, period. Now, that is said in Section 701 of the Internal Revenue Code, and it says a partnership as such shall not be subject to income tax imposed in this chapter, period, which happens to be Chapter 1. And the term partnership is defined way over in 7701A2, I believe. And it says, in part, the term partnership includes an unincorporated organization. Well, our private firm is built on a limited liability company organized in New Mexico. And when you organize one, you get a certificate of organization. So the term partnership in the Internal Revenue Code specifically designates an LLC as something not subject to the income tax imposed in Chapter 1, where most of them are. So the other place the income tax is imposed is, I believe, Chapter 21, and it says that that's where we get FICA and all the Social Security and Medicaid and Medicare and hospitalization and da-da-da taxes. All right. And if you look there, it says for the purposes of this chapter, the term employee is the officer of a corporation. Now, if you look at the definition of employee in 7701, I believe it's C, it says the term employee for the purposes of so-and-so, and it goes on about a 109-word rant, and it gets down and says, includes a full-time life insurance salesman for the purposes of Chapter 21. And, of course, I'm pretty sure most of you out there are not full-time life insurance salesmen. So can you be an employee? Well, are you a full-time life insurance salesman, which, you know, we talked about Flint v. Stone Tracy when they said that the quasi-corporation was insurance companies. So that's how they clue that back in. And then the employee only fits really within those two things, according to the definitions done by these smarmy lexicographers. But it all ties back into that 1909 revenue law. And the tax is upon income, which is the measure, and then the subject to the tax is doing business in the corporate capacity. So our private firm is based on a limited liability company in New Mexico. Now, I'm sure you've heard of other places that do these. Delaware, Nevada, and Wyoming are probably the top three. Delaware, Wyoming, and Nevada do their corporations and LLCs, but they require that the people building these things, applying to do business under that name, if you will, be recorded. New Mexico is a little different. On the application to organize a LLC that goes to the Secretary of State in New Mexico, it requires two parties at a minimum. They are the organizer and the registered agent, both of which can be other LLCs. So I'm pretty sure the smart people out there go, well, that means that an LLC can make an LLC, can organize an LLC, can do it. Yeah, exactly. And each of these backstops, if you will, cause a hindrance to anybody trying to find out who really owns the corporation and controls it. Excuse me, not corporation, LLC, the company. So our company is the organizer, and we have a sister company under our control that is the registered agent. So all of the organization of our private firm via the LLC in New Mexico is controlled under our house. And we don't tell anybody what happens to it after that, and because of the control that we exert upon the new LLC, we keep it utterly private, because the real bodies are nowhere to be found in any public record versus, as I said, Delaware and Nevada and so on. So we build the new LLC, which is the basis of our private firm. Then one of our people that is in a protected spot. The protected spot means that they have not filed a 1040 U.S. individual income tax return. So what that means is the IRS has no jurisdiction over them. So they file and get an EIN for the new company, the new LLC. And because on the paperwork today, the IRS requires a body with a Social Security number to apply for the EIN. Before 2017, that was not the case. A LLC or corporation or trust or anything like that with an EIN could apply for a new EIN. But they keep ratcheting it up so that they can put their finger on a single body. So our protected people go in and get an EIN for the new company. And then because on the paperwork at the IRS, they are listed as a sole member at that point. They also hold a company meeting and have a resolution in which they commission a manager for the new company. And I think last week we used the example of this company is known as XYZ LLC. So XYZ LLC is now duly formed in the state of New Mexico, has an EIN, and it has a manager. And the manager is the only officer of an LLC. LLCs were first legislated about 1977. So where in corporations you have president, secretary, CEO, so forth and so on, and in partnerships you have general partners and limited partners, within the LLC there is only manager. Now, you can put as much stuff in front of that as you want. You know, you can be a chief manager, a chief executive manager, a bottle washer manager, whatever you want, or whatever the company wants, I should say. And the company, instead of being shareholders owning the company is owned by members with a percentage of membership rather than a number of shares. So XYZ LLC now has all of these things, and the manager takes those three pieces of paper down to a bank and gets the company a checking account. And what other things the client would want to have, such as another checking or savings or whatever. And then we bring that all back to our office, put it all together, and we attach a pay-as-you-go cell phone. Here again, we're talking about anonymity, so we don't want any kind of contract sitting out there with Verizon or something like that. So we use a pay-as-you-go cell phone system, a smartphone, program it up with the e-banking site, and we like to use Square and Cash App because Square is a point of sale. And Cash App is an easy way to transfer money peer-to-peer, which can also be used for investments, a very powerful platform. So we put all those together, move the money around, and make sure everything is working, and then we ship it off to our client in private. So the client now has XYZ LLC. He can open the box, fire up the cell phone, and literally start taking payments for any product or service via the cell phone that'll go right into the company accounts, debit card, credit card, or check. Of course, cash is always accepted, but that usually can be put in the bank account if that's what the company wishes. So all of that is done, put it all together, push it over there, and then what we've just built is a new business model. So whatever you do today is your business model. And the we build a brand shiny new one that is totally independent of anybody else's circumstances or history. So no matter what you have said or done or what you filed or what you've answered, questions that should have never been asked, what you've answered, it doesn't make any difference. Because now, also in this box with the cell phone and the checkbook and the debit card and everything else, is a commission for you as a manager of XYZ LLC. So at holding that office, then you can do business worldwide income tax-free under this company structure. As you can see, that's probably a pretty good thing to have. So we, as I said, we built this whole brand new business model, and then there's an integration phase. So whatever you're doing now, you get this new business model in, you want to integrate it, you might want to integrate it a little bit or totally. All that is covered by what we call our hotline services, which is free for the first year and then by subscription. But the subscription is optional. You don't have to use our services anymore if you don't want to. However, if the subscription lapses, there is a pretty good size fee to pay if you call in and need something done in the company structure. And the reason we do all of this, and this is our company motto, is to make you as successful as possible. That pretty much sums up our product and the history that supports it. What are your questions?
Well, I'm going to start with myself, if I may. What is the annual, at this time, the annual fee for support after the first year?
The subscription for hotline services is $500 a year.
$500 a year. Okay, that's inexpensive enough for certain. And that's unlimited support?
Yes. Well, okay, so it normally is, past indications is usually about an hour a month is all anybody ever needs. Now, if there's something dramatic out there, that you want to do, like you want to buy IBM or something like that, then that'll take quite a few more hours. And so we would negotiate a fee for that kind of big endeavor.
Right. But your normal maintenance is going to be $500 a year.
Yes.
That's inexpensive enough. That's cheap, actually. All right. So, and again, the second one is that this is designed for one person to use to create this business model to operate through their business, for their business. Is that correct?
No, it is unlimited. What we build is the structure. So it can be fleshed out to as many people working in the company and for the company as necessary. We have several clients that are running multiple workers, and we don't use the word employee because that's a defined thing in the code. So
sure.
We use workers, and the
sure.
Offices are managers, and then you have workers. And these clients are running, $1 or $2 million a year through this, and with multiple workers involved in the business that they either built up under this original business model or transferred over from an existing business model.
Right. But what I'm asking is, this begins with a single principle, stepping forward,
yes.
Saying, Herr Slevin, make your magic work for me. It's going to be a single
yes.
principle that steps forward. Okay. And what I'm suggesting
typically
is, and I'm looking at a 30,000 foot view, what you've got here is absolutely gorgeous and I love it. I would
Thank
add
you.
To that two charitable religious trusts. Instead of one principle coming in, there'd be two principles coming in, not flesh and blood men and women, but two charitable religious trusts, which are identified by the IRS as non-taxpayers in their
Correct.
Definition. So two CRTs, which Michael Edward could be the trustee, could be the trustee for these two CRTs, or a corporation sole could be the trustee for these two CRTs, approach you and say, make your magic happen, we want to do this LLC. What we've done, I'm someone that, golly, if I'm going to be fighting someone, I mean, like in the old days in high school or whatever, when you have physical fights, let's do it something different. Let's have make this a war. I would have two Overwatch people giving crossfire to where I am so that everything is more secure than what it was secured to begin with. And even though I'm operating out of a tank, i.e., Mr. Slevin's LLC, I still want Overwatch, and those Overwatch, those two Overwatches are the charitable religious trusts that further extend more protection beyond what Mr. Slevin is talking about. And that's just my suggestion. That's the way that I would set it up differently from what Mr. Slevin is offering. You can do it the way he's offering, $7,500. But I would add 2,000. I would add two charitable religious trusts buffering between myself and what Mr. Slevin is doing, this LLC, to just fully embrace the protection that both systems afford, is what I'm saying. So with that having been said, we have already someone who's raised their hand. Let me give you the to ask a question for Herr Slevin, press star 2 on your keypad, star 2. It's just that little asterisk underneath the number 7 on your keypad, star 2. And on my end, you'll pop up, and when I get in your turn, I'll just unmute you, and you can feel free to ask any question or make any comment to Mr. Slevin. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, we got a good crowd sitting over there. You'll see to the center right of your monitor a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. It's empty. Left-click inside of it and type away your comment or your question. And I'll be happy to give voice. On the outside of it, there's a place to put your name and so forth, and then just hit submit. So with that having been said, let's open up the first caller is Michael from Las Vegas. Go ahead, Michael.
Thank you. Can I use this as a wage earner? In other words, I'm a union iron worker, so can I get my check or have it where I can run my check through this corporation?
Yes. First of all, it's not a corporation. It is a limited liability company.
Right.
Okay. And I don't mean to be overburdensome, but terminology matters greatly in this venue. So that's why I always make sure that you and I both understand exactly what terminology needs to be used and use it properly. So anyway, as a wage earner, you now have a contract between an employee and an employer, okay? The employee uses his tax identification number, which is usually a Social Security number. But as I said in the explanation, that's built in Title II of the Social Security Act of 1935, and over in Title VIII is where the tax is laid. So it's two separate things. Nonetheless, the lexicographers being smarmy buggers, they've got to make things as unintelligible as possible and still say what they really want to say. So the Social Security number is used as a tax identification number for the employee in contract with the employer. The employer has an employer identification number, or EIN, of the type that it must pay what most people call the other half of Social Security, but that's in Title VIII as well, Title IX, I believe, which is a separate tax on the same measure, which is the income. Anyway, so you've got a contract between the employee and the employer. So this contract is based on your services for compensation and benefits and .. whatever that may be. All right. All of those costs affect the bottom line of the employer, all right? And it's measured by a thing called the burden rate. And so the burden rate is normally 1.5 to 1.6 times the salary that the employee gets, whether that's paid as a salary or hourly, doesn't matter. So the way that we negotiate this new contract, which instead of going from the employee to the employer, it will now go from an employee to an LLC, which is another employer according to the tax code, but that doesn't matter in our case. So, but it's going between two entities. And the way you negotiate this, which is this has been accomplished multiple times, so we know it works, the old employee will go to the employer and go, hey, Joe, I'd like to renegotiate our contract. Instead of you paying me X and you're getting all these other costs, which is costing you, and we'll use round numbers, you're paying me $100,000 a year. Well, I know because of the burden rate that it's costing you $160,000 a year. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to renegotiate this working relationship. And we say, okay, this LLC will now sign the contract as the intermediary for my services. You get the same guy reporting at the same time, doing the same great job. Everything's the same. But instead of paying $160,000 a year to cover those costs, you'll only have to pay $120,000 a year, which means that you'll cut one check per month of $10,000 to this LLC. The LLC will then take care of everything else. I'll still show up, do the same great job, and everybody will be happy, but your cost has gone down by some 30%. The LLC is making a little bit more money, but that's only fair. And we'll take care of all the whatever taxes that are we're liable for or anything like that. So that'll all be taken care of. So your bookkeeping goes down, your cost goes down, and you get the same great service. What are your objections to that deal? So that's a little bit of an explanation of how the negotiation. Of course, all negotiations are more detailed than that, but that's the general framework of it. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. I tried to do a W-8 bid, non-resident alien, when the last job I had, but their bookkeeper, their CPA wouldn't accept it.
Yeah.
So it's if you take it on the burden rate, then I'm sure once he starts looking at the numbers, they just jump all over that.
Yeah, because and in that situation, what's normally generated is called a 1099. All right, these are the W-2 is for normal employees, and then 1099, 1098, K-2s, and there's a couple of others. All of these things are called third-party reporting, because as far as the IRS is concerned, it's the first party, and you, because you owe it money, are the second party. And then everybody that tells on you that you've got money is called the third party. And so that's what employers would be. And so the third party reporting is how the IRS learns about everything. Unless they go out and do a active investigation of somebody's finances, the only way they ever hear anything is third party reporting. So all the third party reporting in the situation we just described would be reported upon the LLC and its EIN or tax identification number. So, and because of Section 701 that I quoted earlier, when the IRS gets a 1099 on this LLC, it looks at it and goes, oh, that's fine, and drops it in the trash can because the LLC is not subject to the income tax, and therefore they have no place to settle that third party reporting with. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I've tried to go every which way at them with the W-8 bin and then with Section 83A, because unless otherwise noted or any person required, you have to define person and required, and the other portion of the tax code where it goes to, I forget what section it was in, but it says unless otherwise noted, and that's Section 83A, that puts you if you're a wage earner and not an employee, you're an arm's length from the company. You don't own it. You're not getting any stock or any dividend. And the only thing you could possibly get would be excess. And they define excess as whatever you're given outside of the contract that you're doing. But if you include whatever you're doing to include the excess, which would be company's going to give you a welding machine or a truck at the end of the job, then that wouldn't be taxable either, according to their rule.
Right.
But this sounds much easier to do here.
Yes, it is. And because it's something that they already do. I mean, because they've got, they probably, you know, if they've got a building, they've got a cleaning crew that comes in and cleans the building. You know, that's under the umbrella of a limited liability company or some other entity. And so, you know, those guys are cleaning the building, or they've got, you know, if they have a fleet of trucks, they may hire a maintenance company. And so the maintenance company and the employer, if you will, have the contract, and then the maintenance company pays its workers to fix the employer's vehicles or whatever. But so this is a normal way of doing business. And so they understand it easier, and they understand the burn rate very well, even though they'll say they don't sometimes, because they just don't want to admit that we found out something that they kept trying to keep secret. So it's you know, versus Section 83 or Section, you know, 861 or whatever, you know, that, you know, very few people have ever read, much less understand. So it's something that they do as a normal course of business. And the phrase that we always talk about is called standard business practices. Okay, so this is just one more standard business practice they're already doing. It's just to your benefit rather than totally to theirs or the IRS's. Make sense?
Sounds good to me.
All right.
So the simple side of it is that Michael pays you to create Working Iron LLC. And when he goes to his next job, he pitches them to hire Working Iron LLC, and he'll show up to do the work, just like anything else.
Yeah, they would not hire. They would contract with Working Iron LLC. Here again, terminology, because hire
Stanker
infers an employee, if you will.
Right.
So contract with Working Iron LLC for the services of Mike.
Yep. That's the way to do it. Fantastic. Anything else, Michael?
No, that's it. Thank you.
All right. When can I expect your call?
Sorry.
Always a salesman.
I show up, and the first thing I do is I take my sales pad and I lay it down and I start saying, your name, and how do you spell your name? Oh, I'm horrible.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Next is Kent. Go ahead, Kent.
Yes, good evening. Could you talk a little bit about, since the first question from Michael was about a union situation, could you talk a little about pensions that would be inside of a union contract or someone who was working inside a union, and what would happen with that from two points, number one, moving forward, and number two, for things that were already paid into a pension plan or into something like some unions have, or maybe some other employers actually, an annuity plan. So could you look at it from the past and moving forward and discuss that a little bit, please?
Truly, I don't think I've ever thought about that, so give me a second. Everything's contract. So the union contract, you know, it's collective bargaining and so forth, and then you have the union organization and the pensions and whatever benefits are allotted to the union members and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing would be, we'll go ahead and use the examples first stated, Working Iron LLC. So Working Iron LLC would then talk to the union rep on the job and say, okay, you know, we're doing things this way. I'm sure the union has dealt with what's typically in the business called the subcontractors. And so the Working Iron LLC would probably be labeled as that, as a subcontractor. And then, so that would be an individual negotiation with the union and with their processes, because I know they've got them in there. You know, they've been doing this, particularly the ironworkers union, that's been around forever. So I'm sure that that's been addressed prior to. So, as far as the union member, then their functioning under the Working Iron LLC would probably also have been addressed by the union policymakers. So, and that would be who you would ask. Okay, And that was, that's one thing I forgot to do in the thing in the opening statement. Everybody, every institution, if you will, out there has policy. The policy is crafted by law, statutes, regulations, and the whoever runs that particular institution, whatever it would be, members, shareholders, board of directors, whoever it is, whoever sits there and thinks about things. So when you want to go and contract with an institution at whatever level, then you have to find out their policy, because that's what they, that's the language that they speak. And we've come to the determination that, and we use the word bureaucrat to cover both government and non-government institutions. So when you go and you're talking to a bureaucrat and you're talking about contracts, they only understand what's in their policy manual. And so if you try to venture very far out of that language, they shut down. And the old phrase is, we don't do that around here. So when you're discussing these different venues and different ways of doing business, different ways of contracting, you got to know who you're talking to and what their policy is. And the best way to find that out, of course, is just to ask the questions. So that would be the overall way to go into this particular union job working. To the answer to the first part of your question, looking in the past where Mike, in this example, was a union member and he had already been paid into a certain pension or savings plan or retirement plan or whatever, then that would not change, because his membership is but the contract between him and the union. And so whatever those benefits and or requirements are, they are in that institution. Does that pretty well cover your question?
Well, it does to a certain extent. I think it would need a little honing. I mean, there are certain unions in the country where not only do you have now an employer that is a member of the union who is hiring an employee under normal circumstances, then you have the union as a third party. In some cases, there's another board that controls all the benefits, et cetera. So this could become a little complicated. I think this would have to be probably, you know, thought through to a greater extent. Now, if someone was to address the second part that was already paid in, so that might be what would be called quote unquote taxable income, except if someone had corrected their status, then they could remove, even though those items were accumulated from the past, I would think they'd be able to then remove them from the taxing system, whether they be annuities, pensions, medical benefits that may somehow be taxable as a benefit, et cetera. Would that be basically a correct statement on my part, or do you think that there's a couple of holes in what I'm saying?
No, yeah, that's a good overall way of looking at it. But here again, it just goes back to what I said. Whatever institution you're looking at contracting with, you got to figure out their policies, and the best way to do that is ask them. So, you know, once you it's just like you know, you've often heard of a good idea fairy. So the good idea fairy shows up, and I'll tell you, my father, who was he worked in a factory for a lot of years, then he got his own property and ran a bulldozer for the last 25 years of his life as a one-man land clearing operation. And he came up with this phrase, and he called it, says, not all good ideas work out. And that comes specifically from a time where they had a big Kubota tractor, and the clutch had stuck, so it would not disengage. So my youngest brother said, hey, Daddy, if we'll take and put that front of that nose of that truck or that tractor up next to that big old oak tree there, and I'll stand on the clutch pedal and we'll crank it up, and I think that'll break that clutch loose. And Daddy goes, you know, that's a good idea. So they got the tractor over there and put it up against this 40-inch oak tree, and little brother popped it, stood on the clutch, cranked the tractor up and promptly buried its wheels all the way down to the axle. So he shut the thing off, and they're looking at the buried tractor, and they go, my daddy goes, well, not all good ideas work out.
Yep. All right, I think that's based on my question, that's an adequate answer at this time, but I would want to think that through a little more, actually.
Well, yeah. And this here again, this is what would fall under our integration services. Okay, because you know, there are innumerable details to any deal. And so we would have to sit down and talk about this. You know, who's the parties involved, what is their policy? If we don't know, we ask, and then you know, and then work through it. But the general idea is always sound, because you know, it's just standard business practices.
Now let me ask one more question regarding the fact that you said you were using Square and another platform, and there was some problems with changes with Bank America, et cetera, from my understanding, with opening bank accounts. Would you think that what Michael is suggesting regarding the two CRTs, that would cover that banking problem, if you want to call it a problem, that one is working around, or that you would be working around with apps or some other online service?
Yes, having a CRT, a charitable religious trust, as the beneficial owner on the brick and mortar bank account is one way of doing it. Another way of doing it would be having our company situated so as that, and then it contracting to the trust. But that would alleviate some of the problems our brick and mortar providers have issued in recently. There are several online platforms, and they don't care. So, yeah, all of these are good, and all of these are a part of our ever fluctuating business, because I don't know if y'all remember, but last year Biden floated the idea of every checking account in America that had more than $600 a year flow through it had to be reported to the IRS. And so everybody screamed and said that was insane, which he is, but nonetheless, that apparently was sidelined. Well, what they did was they just backed off from the legislative side and went in and did banking regulations. And so the banking world has become Biden's bitch, from what we can tell by our intel. And so we have to adapt to that. But as Gunny Highway in the great movie Heartbreak Ridge said, we will adapt, improvise, and overcome.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much for your response. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All righty. Thank you. Yeah, I was just getting ready to utter those very same words. You're wrong.
The great minds think alike, right, Mike?
Yeah, been there, done that, got the T-shirt and all the crap that went with it. All right.
With the holes in it.
Really. All right. Michael's back again for another bite at the apple, but before we do, we have a question over on Freedom's Radio. Jim writes in, and I'm going to take this as an opportunity to expound for clarity's sake. Jim writes in from Oregon.
Sounds great.
Though I'm not seeing a distinction between this and that of depositing, quote, taxable income, end quote, directly into a charitable religious trust, which we have learned is called commingling funds, making the entire CRT bank account taxable. Thank you. So let's talk about this. First off, it never reaches a taxable income status according to the business model that Herr Slevin here is offering. But in the event that the fit were to hit the shan, the CRTs are there to eventually be replaced by two foreign grantor trusts out of Belize. And you, Jim, being on the call, know that I'm now beginning to talk about the golden horseshoe that Judge Bernie offers. What Herr Slevin is offering is not to replace Bernie's operation, Bernie's Golden Horseshoe. It's not there to do that. It's there to augment it. Rather than use the the LLC that comes with Bernie's program, we're utilizing the LLC slash business model of Herr Slevin here to begin the procedure with. And as long as you've got the two CRTs there receiving these funds, which, according to Mr. Slevin, have already been stripped of their taxable duty, regardless, sometime in the future, you're going to gear in with the entire foreign grantor trusts, three of them, the two of them that would take the place of the two CRTs, which you can use in some other form or fashion elsewhere, and then the parent foreign grantor trust receiving the funds from those two foreign grantor trust, funneling that money then over to the private interest foundation in Panama, and then back up to the corporation Sol and its CRTs here in the States. So it's adding an extra insulation both sides of the coin. It's an extra insulation on what Herr Slevin is offering in this business model, and it's an extra layer of insulation by coming in without having taxable presence to begin with for the what will be the two foreign grantor trusts replacing the two CRTs that we're starting with now. So I hope that answers your question. Yes, sir.
Michael, if I may, probably one of a better definition of what we do is would be known as an interface, okay? Because it is an interface under standard business practices. So every, and we'll use the word employer as an encompassing thing, every employer understands standard business practices. They know what an LLC is. They know what contracts are and how they work, you know, because that's what they do every day. So this is an interface. And all business done under this interface is income tax free. So wherever those proceeds go, they have no income tax attached to it because of Section 701 of the Internal Revenue Code. All right.
Correct.
That interface, and then the CRTs being the beneficial owner of the private firm that we build, AKA LLC, is the recipient of those, but all that money is not considered income either. It is just the proceeds of a business activity that is not subject to the income tax. So it makes it invisible to the IRS, for lack of a better term, because there's no third party reporting on any of this.
Correct. And the reason that I'm suggesting this layering with the two CRTs eventually being replaced by two foreign grantor trusts and something called the Golden Horseshoe is because in the event that your business model, as you so eloquently put it, was buried down to its axle, okay, if that happened, then you're still within a business model, an arrangement of your affairs, and I'm quoting Judge Learned Hand, that enables you to strip those tax liabilities anyways by following this procedure. So that's why I say it's a double win for you. It's a double win for Bernie in regards to the student ultimately being the winner, the grand winner in both instances. It's just an extra safety net. It's those two Overwatch people with their 50 cows, half a mile away, three quarter mile away. Anyways, that's just what I'm saying.
Yeah, and if I might, the way it really works in America today is the federal judiciary has come to the belief that that any human that files an 1040 U.S. individual income tax return with the files assigned 1040 with the IRS accepts liability for the income tax for life. So that is a situation that is neither moral, lawful, or constitutional, but they get paid a whole lot of money to keep that way going. All right. So that's the bottom line of what you're doing. So by working, via the private firm owned by the various trusts and
you know, all the money becomes invisible, if you will, and you can't tax something that's invisible, can you? Anyway, it all becomes invisible and flows back to, and because, you know, the three people, the three parties of a trust are the grantor, the trustee, and the beneficiary. And so everything that is done, all these layers and all this stripping, if you will, is all to the benefit of the beneficiary, and so that they can have a great life and be well protected.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say that the judiciary was making God in their own image.
We won't go there yet.
Okay. Next and last is Michael from Las Vegas coming back with another question. Go ahead, buddy.
Gary, are making God in their own image. They're priests. They wear black robes. They're a church. They're bankers and they're a church. And they're demons. Yeah. But anyway, what we were discussing earlier, iron workers can contract and the union provides for that so that I can go out and contract or I can do work and pay my own benefits in. And once we do that, then we can wash it all the way through whichever way we want to go then. Section 83A, I didn't get no excess or the other way. And either way, there's no, like you said, there's no third party reporting because I'm not going to tell you that, get on the phone and say, well, to them and tell them what I'm doing. It's, hey, I'm one of the people of the independent, freely associated, independent compact states. And, don't belong to their corporation and I'm not participating. So
there you go.
Yeah, just so that, you know, when people, I don't know about other unions, but the iron workers, you can go contract, pay your own benefits in, and I can go ahead and pay my, if I wanted to give them $20,000 a year and pay my pension credits, but I'm too old now because then I'd have to live to be 100 in order to get that money back out. But I could pay the pension credits right now and get a bigger check every month. But hell, if I'm going to pay $20,000, I'll go invest it in something else. Like, you know, currency that's going to go up in value because there's only 38 million people in the country. And sooner or later, the people running the country are going to all perish. And it's going to change. And their monetary value has no other way to go but up because they have nothing but resources, more resources in the ground than they have people to spend it on. So that's my spiel for the night.
Okay. All right. Anything else? Do you have any closing comments you'd like to make, Heslevin?
No, but I want to say thank you very much, Michael, for inviting me to be with your associates and enjoy touting freedom. Thank you.
Yeah. We're having a good time. Good time. Thank you all for joining us. I want to remind you, if you don't have my direct number, to reach out to 800-625-4250, 1-800-625-4250, and I will be happy to assist with any questions to be answered and or connect you directly here with Heslevin for a private consult, and we'll move from there. So until then, till next week, I want to remind you, Saturday, Judge Bernie, Justice Beshear, with regards to the ultimate in asset protection, followed by Monday's correcting your status call with GW, followed Tuesday by John regarding litigation, utilizing these two tools, status and asset protection, to maximize your leverage in any kind of litigation. And, of course, tonight's call will be back again. Until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.